Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The minimum salary for public school teachers in Pennsylvania is $18,500. That minimum was established in 1988. Governor Tom Wolf has proposed increasing the minimum salary to $45,000 a year. About 3,000 teachers would see an immediate raise if the minimum is increased. It's estimated to cost $14 million, which the state making up the difference. Joining us in this portion of today's program is Chris Lilienthal, Assistant Director of Communications with the Pennsylvania State Education Association, the state's largest teachers union. Chris Lilienthal, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, I'll start with a basic question, Chris. Why do you think that, I'm sure your support what the governor is doing, but why do you think that that minimum salary should be raised to $45,000 a year?
You are right, Scott. We are supporting the governor's proposal. PSA believes that raising the minimum educator salary will help Pennsylvania school districts across the board be able to recruit and retain the best and brightest to teach our students. I know you've talked about this in the past. I know a lot of people talked about a teacher shortage in Pennsylvania. And it is real and it is growing. And this is one strategy in the effort to address that. Because when we talk about teacher shortages, pay enters the picture, especially in some of the most rural and urban school districts that are struggling and would benefit from this proposal. The other consideration that we think about a lot with this proposal is the impact on students. There's good research that tells us that when educator turnover is high in a school district, that takes a toll on student achievement. So if we can set up a system here with a targeted state investment that allows more school districts to be able to recruit and hold on to those really good teachers, that's going to ultimately be very good for student achievement. And then the third consideration, which is obviously very important to PSEA and to our members, is the impact it will have on the lives of educators. I have had the opportunity to meet dozens of educators over the past couple months who would be impacted by this proposal. Many of them hold second, third jobs. They have large student loan payments that they struggle to afford. Many are at an age where they're starting to have families, and they're having a very difficult time providing for their families. And we just believe that if you put in the time, the education level to become a teacher, you should not have to scrape by. You should be able to make a living, pay your bills, pay your student loan, and have time with your family.
Here are some of the other numbers as well. The average teacher salary in Pennsylvania is $67,000 a year. That's the salary. When benefits are included in this, it's closer to $100,000. We're looking at about an estimate of 3,200 teachers across the state that are making less than the $45,000 right now. It's over about 180 districts. So when you say that there are teachers that are leaving the profession or maybe not even becoming part of the profession overpay, what are we talking about? I mean, yeah, those are real numbers, but of those 3,200, how many have left? How many have, give me a sense of people who are teachers who are saying, I just cannot afford to do this anymore.
Well, we can look at it from a few different angles. One is we've seen a dramatic decline over the past 15 years in the number of college students in Pennsylvania who are studying and graduating with degrees in education. So we're seeing fewer people pursuing this profession at the college level. We've seen a decline in the number of teaching certificates that have been issued by the state. And we've heard anecdotally from many districts just the difficulty in finding candidates for certain positions, especially in the fields of special education and some of the science and STEM fields, which are incredibly important fields. So we certainly have seen that as an impact. The other thing to keep in mind is that not only do we risk losing these teachers to neighboring districts, we risk losing them to neighboring states. When you look at the school districts in New York, New Jersey, Maryland, that border Pennsylvania, nearly every one of them has a starting salary of $45,000 or just slightly higher than that. So we already are at a disadvantage where we're having fewer people going into the profession. The last thing we need is to be losing more high-quality educators to neighboring states.
Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the bottom lines for when we have this discussion is whether students are being impacted. Are they?
Most definitely. There's, as I said, there's good research that shows when educator turnover at a school district is higher, that does impact students. When students have access to really high quality educators who have been in this position for many years and have a lot of experience, and also can carry through with those students year after year after year. And you know what? We don't often think about this. We think about it in an academic context, but we talk a lot about school safety and having those adults, those trusted adults that students can look to and connect with. That's also part of our strategy in looking at school safety. We want to make sure that kids have teachers that they can turn to when they have difficulties.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring in Hannah Barrick, who is Director of Advocacy with the Pennsylvania Association of School Business Officials. Ms. Barrick, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Your organization has come out, I don't know whether it's accurate to say in opposition, but you have raised some objections to increasing this minimum salary to $45,000. Why?
That's right. So I think overall we are in general agreement with a lot of the position where you know, PSEA is, as well as the administration, in terms of we value teachers. We, you know, understand the challenges that are out there with making sure we get good teachers in the classroom and that we're able to retain them. And so providing additional salary and making sure that salary is competitive is really, really important. I think our sort of disagreement and concern with the proposal really comes from some of the financial implications for school districts that result from the sort of mandated increase, as well as some of the policy implications that will be impacted through in the collective bargaining process. And so I think from our perspective, it's really not the what, it's the how. And how we get there, how we make that, is where we have those concerns.
All right. Well, you said that generally you don't disagree with the idea behind it, but you do have disagreement with how. How would you do that? Would you advise, or do you have a position on that?
Right. So I think one of the things that, you know, right now the salary is determined, as well as everything else, and during the collective bargaining process. And so school districts come to the table, the employee union comes to the table, and, you know, they work out a whole collective bargaining agreement that includes everything from salary to a whole heck of a lot of other things. So paid time off and classroom assignments and planning time, all worked out between the school district and the employee union. I think what we have seen over a period of time is that, you know, there has been prioritization in that process, very limited resources that are available to allocate, but prioritization towards the teachers who are there in the building. Maybe it's career earnings, and that is where the additional resources are allocated. Maybe it is in other areas of total compensation, but there really hasn't been a lot of, in some of these districts that would be impacted, there hasn't been a lot of focus on working with folks who are at the beginning or the bottom of the salary scale. And so I think from our perspective, the best way to go about this to ensure that you're not creating any negative financial implications for a school district, you're not creating any situation where you're going to have to increase property taxes, where you're going to have to potentially, you know, cut programs or reduce staff, which is going to have a negative implication on students. You know, we have a process that works. We can do it through that process. And I think that the folks at the table really have to prioritize the folks at the bottom of that pay scale. And we can get to the same result without going through the sort of process that we have proposed right now.
Chris, why not rely on the collective bargaining system?
Well, let's be clear. The educators in the districts that would be impacted have been strong advocates at the bargaining table for higher starting salaries for many years. And in many school districts, it's difficult to accomplish because the local tax base just can't sustain it. And that is why Governor Wolf has proposed a targeted state investment along with this increase in the minimum
wage
salary.
That is what's different about this, is the governor governor is proposing the state would make up the estimated $14 million difference.
That's correct, yes. And so by doing that, we can make sure that local taxpayers are not footing the bill for something that might be unsustainable for this local taxpayers. So we think it's the right strategy for everyone. It's a win-win, I think, for educators, students, and local communities.
Hannah, that $14 million that the Wolf administration is estimating, there have been some that say that's not enough, that that is a minimum, that's a conservative estimate, especially when they go a step further and say that there will be a ripple effect, mm-hmm. that not only will the starting salary go up, but those teachers who have been there for a while will get raises that will take it up even more. Mm-hmm. Do you think that $14 million is a good estimate?
I don't think we do. I think there are a lot of other financial concerns and considerations that aren't built into that $14 million number. And so the sort of concerns are twofold. So one, in terms of the school districts that are impacted, those sort of 180, there are some things that are not folded into that calculation that is sort of determining that salary subsidy that they would get. So one, you know, the employer contribution rate increases every year. And so the way that this would work is they get sort of a flat amount one time. They're going to get that from year to year. But we know that employer contribution rate right now for 1920 districts are paying about 35 cents on every dollar of salary. That's going to continue to increase. Additionally, there's some other costs that haven't been built in as well, including increases in the charter school tuition costs, which are going to go up as you put more money into school district budgets.
All these things are kind of tied together.
Exactly.
I mean, we could have another conversation about charter schools and the formula.
Right, exactly. But then the other side, the ripple effect, which you mentioned, is something that we definitely think is going to be an issue. So you have a teacher who has been working in a school district for 5 or 6 years. He or she is making just over 45. We now have a new teacher who comes in at 45. Certainly when that contract is renegotiated, there will be, from the union, a push to really increase and adjust all those increments in the salary schedule up accordingly.
But shouldn't it be that way? I mean, if you're going to increase the starting salary to $45,000, I mean, it only makes sense that those who have been there for a while are going to get raises.
Oh, yeah. And again, I don't think we're in disagreement with that. I think we are just in it needs to be a process through the collective bargaining process where school districts have the ability to sort of negotiate this and make sure that they have the financial resources in place long term to be able to cover those costs. We really don't want to get into a situation where we have from 1 year to the next, everybody moves a step in the salary schedule and we have an Act One index that can't cover that. That's a really financially challenging position for a school district to be in, and we don't want to be there.
Just for context, Act One, something that was passed by the legislature years ago now, mm-hmm. I forget, how many years has it been?
2006,
okay, so it's been 13 years, that limits the amount of property tax increases that a school district can do. It also was to give school districts options on how to generate revenue. That hasn't changed a whole lot, though. The overwhelming majority of school districts are relying on property taxes, just for context sake. We're going to have more of this conversation in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk and WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Be sure to check out some upcoming topics for Smart Talk, including tomorrow, where we have a researcher coming into the area, and we'll be speaking with him tomorrow about Alzheimer's, the latest research into Alzheimer's disease that's coming up on tomorrow's program. If you're not able to listen to the program, we hope you can, or call in or send an email. We do take voice memos. Just go to WITF.org/smarttalk, and you can leave a question in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. But during this portion of today's program, we're talking about a proposal made by Governor Wolf in his budget address back in February that would increase the minimum salary for teachers in Pennsylvania to $45,000 a year. Right now, it is $18,500. That was established in 1988. Our guest during this portion of the program is Chris Lilienthal, who is Assistant Director of Communications with PSEA, the Pennsylvania State State Education Association, the state's largest teachers union, and Hannah Barrick, Director of Advocacy with the Pennsylvania Association of School Business Officials. We know you have opinions on this. Do you think that after hearing just a little bit of our discussion, your feelings on increasing the minimum salary for teachers in Pennsylvania? 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Chris, I want to give you the opportunity to touch on what Hannah just discussed before our break. And we were talking about that ripple effect that, yes, we're talking about 3,200 teachers in 180 school districts across the state right now. But wouldn't there be a ripple effect that would cost more than $14 million?
Well, to be sure, our educators are strong advocates for themselves and for their colleagues and their students.
I'm sure you are.
And they will most definitely advocate for good salaries, good benefits, as we always do. But we've been hearing about this idea of a ripple effect. So we went back and we looked at what happened in 1988. The last time that the minimum teacher salary was increased. And what we found was over the 4 years before that law went into effect in 88, average teacher salary in Pennsylvania grew at a rate of about 3.1%. The 4 years after that law passed, it grew at a rate of 2.8%. So there was actually a slight decline in annual growth in average teacher salary after that law went into effect. Certainly many things go into that, but there is some evidence there that there wasn't some sort of unsustainable ripple effect after that happened. And one thing to keep in mind today is that since then, Pennsylvania, as you mentioned earlier, passed Act 1 and have capped property tax increases. So when you sit down at the bargaining table, there's two sides to the table, and certainly a school board would have to agree to what the contract is along with the local association. So we can be very strong advocates, but at the end of the day, it is a collaborative process that has to come to an agreement. So we don't think that unsustainable ripple effects would really be a big concern with this proposal.
What about those districts that you mentioned earlier that where the tax base is suffering? Mm-hmm. I mean, rural districts would seem to be places where the tax base, maybe there's potential to grow, but right now it is limited as number of properties that they have in their districts, people losing jobs, or there's not the businesses that there once were, employers that once were. Rural districts, now there have been a couple ways to look at this. Some are saying that rural districts would suffer under this, but then there are others who say, no, rural districts are going to benefit because they're going to get more money from the state. So what do you say to that?
Yeah, well, I think that the whole goal of this proposal is to target the state funding in a way that it can lift up those rural communities by paying educators more fairly in line with what educators make in other parts of the state. Is obviously good for those educators who, as I mentioned, are often struggling with student loans. They have more stringent continuing education requirements today than they did 30 years ago. Many are pursuing master's degrees. So certainly it's good for them, but it's also good for students. It's good for communities. It lifts up local communities when educators have more money to be able to spend in those local communities. I think the other thing, too, is that the state funding isn't a once and done. It continues. It continues year after year.
That is a key to this, right?
Yes, absolutely. And, when you look at how a salary schedule works in a contract, teachers move up those salary schedules naturally year after year. So in that first year, the state funding will pay for that increase in salary for those lowest paid educators up to $45,000. But then as those educators rise up the salary schedule, that funding continues to be there. So when you look at and have concerns about higher pension costs, higher charter school costs in future years, that state funding does continue and does provide some support for those districts.
Hannah Barrick, what about the rural districts, some of the districts that don't have that large tax base or are suffering right now because of it?
Mm-hmm. No, and I agree. That's one of the concerns that we have, particularly if you look at the map of the school districts that are impacted. There are a lot of them in sort of more rural areas of Pennsylvania, where even if you look at sort of the median household income in some of those areas, it's less than $45,000. Certainly in those communities, they are some of the most impacted by this proposal. And you're right, some of them are in situations where they have a declining assessed value. They don't have a property tax base. And so when we start to think about some of the financial implications of this, even though they are getting a flat amount from the state that will be there sort of locked in place into the future, it doesn't grow when their costs grow. It doesn't grow when the employer contribution rate goes up. It doesn't grow when the charter school tuition costs go up as a result of getting that salary subsidy. And so that makes it a lot more difficult for those school districts to sort of get back to sort of level with a proposal like this. And it is those school districts as well that I think we have the largest concern with respect to the ripple effect. So in some of those districts, they have many, many steps in a salary schedule that are below 45. And so there will be, at the point when they renegotiate a contract, potentially a pretty significant change with a pretty significant financial impact for a school district that's going to put them in a situation where they have to go to, raise property taxes, which is, again, we have Act One that's limited. They might not have the tax base to be able to sustain that. The other option that school districts have on the table is to sort of make cuts to programs or staff, and certainly that is not a direction we want to go either. Those are the districts, some of those districts are the ones that we're really the most concerned about, and sort of having their business officials running some of those numbers, I think they have concerns about how sustainable this will be, even though that revenue would be there sort of locked in place from year to year.
You know, I said earlier about how so many of these issues are interrelated. We have an email here from a listener who says the discussion must include funding, meaning property tax. And there have been a number of discussions out there about eliminating the property tax. And they have, I won't say they haven't gone anywhere, because the last few years, those proposals have been taken much more seriously in the Pennsylvania legislature than they were, say, 10, 15, 20 years ago. But let's talk about that. Is that part of the issue here? Is property taxes, the way that school districts are able to generate revenue, is that part of the issue here?
It certainly is, and I think that's why PSEA has been an advocate for increased state funding of public education across the board, and it is something that Governor Wolf has made a priority during his tenure in office, because there is a recognition that there are three legs to the stool. You know, there's federal funding, there's state funding, and then there's local funding. And when you look at communities in a state as diverse as Pennsylvania, we have some of the biggest cities and we have some of the smallest towns, and everything's going to be very different depending on where you go. And we have 500 school districts. So we need to make sure that at the state level, we're stepping up and making the investments that our local communities need. And that is why, with this minimum salary proposal, when we started talking about this, we really felt that it was important for a state investment to be made so that it could be affordable.
Hannah, I don't know whether your organization has a position on property tax elimination or how the best way to for school districts to pay for themselves to generate revenue, but from your perspective, how does property tax tie into all this?
Property tax ties into everything in every discussion. And as Chris said, it really is very much tied to the state investment in education. And again, school districts really have to balance state and local resources. And again, that looks different in every single one of our 500 school districts. I think that, my association, PASBO, has always been very much adamantly opposed to property tax elimination. However, we're at a different place
Why?
Now.
Why?
Because it's not sustainable for school districts. We don't like the idea of all the money going to Harrisburg, making sure that money comes back appropriately to school districts. You have a huge sort of shift in those resources across the state if you are just, sort of doing a dollar-for-dollar property tax and sort of just locking in place what you've got in education funding right now. It doesn't really give us an opportunity to sort of move forward, to grow, to sort of undo some of the inequity and the disparity that exists. costs. And so, you know, we had the opportunity back in 2017 when there was a referendum, and so folks were able to amend the PA Constitution to increase the amount of homestead and farmstead relief to 100% of the individual assessed value of a property. That gives us a really different way and a different lens through which to look at property tax relief, which I think is really positive. Again, I think from our perspective, we have to look at property tax relief at the same time that we look for at additional funding for schools, because we have two important components that have to work together. We have to be able to provide relief to taxpayers through taxpayer equity. We have to also be able to provide relief to and additional funding to schools to ensure that we have that student equity, too. And as we provide more money to schools on one side, that's going to reduce the need for additional property taxes and ensure that they don't continue to increase. So this is really all one giant conversation that we sort of keep having.
But you said that you do not support more from the state. Chris said the PSEA does. Pennsylvania, in fact, our second segment of the program today is going to be an explainer on property taxes here in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is fourth from the bottom when it comes to state, how much the state provides to school districts across the state. So there is that. You know, something else that we really haven't talked about either is, you know, some of what is really growing in this state that has to be dealt with is the pension situation. And that is something that is just eating away at school budgets. Again, all this tied in. Chris, how do you see that?
The pensions, in the context of this minimum teacher salary proposal, it wouldn't have an impact on the pension liability because that's calculated
right
at the career rate. In terms of reforms going forward, as you probably recall, there was a pension reform bill that was just passed recently. It's going into effect, I believe, this year or
July 1.
July 1, yes. Thank you, Hannah. So there have been steps that have been taken. That was obviously a very difficult process. There was a lot of compromises on all sides. PSA was part of that discussion, lawmakers from both parties, the governor. So I think we are going in the right direction there with pensions. It's critical to make sure that we preserve those benefits for the educators who've worked hard and have retired and earned it.
We are almost out of time for this portion of the program. So much to discuss. Thank both of you for being with us today. Chris, there's not legislation that has been proposed yet for this minimum salary. When will there be?
State Representative Tara Tuhill, a Republican from Luzerne County, State Senator Judy Schwenk, a Democrat from Berks County, they are the prime sponsors, a bipartisan group there. They are collecting co-sponsors right now. We expect to have the legislation introduced a little bit later this month.
Chris Lilienthal from the Pennsylvania State Education Association, Hannah Barrick from the Pennsylvania Association of School Business Officials. Again, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. What to do about property taxes is a question that has plagued Pennsylvania for the past half century. Property taxes are no doubt the most unpopular tax in the state. However, efforts to reduce or eliminate property taxes have largely failed. The online news site PA Post recently answered a reader's question that provided a good update on where we stand with property taxes here in Pennsylvania. Joining us is PA Post reporter Ed Mahan. Ed, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
So kind of walk us through how you got this question that led to what we call an explainer on property taxes.
We have a listening post feature on PA Post. Readers can submit questions. And one of the questions came from Bob Smith. He's retired, living in Schuylkill County. And he wanted to know about property taxes.
Well, let's listen to Bob Smith's question right now.
I'm a senior citizen, age 66, living in Schuylkill County. I pay property taxes of about $4,000 per year on a home valued at about $170,000. That's way too much. What factors keep these taxes in force?
All right, so that's a question that many Pennsylvanians have been asking over the last 40 to 50 years. So, Ed, go at it. What are some of the factors that keep these property taxes in force?
So we came up with five big ones, and I'll run through them. One is other taxes would have to rise. Two is it would be a really big change, especially for Pennsylvania. Three, there are a wide range of opponents. 4, Governor Tom Wolf is not on board. And 5, any shift risks a backlash from voters.
All right. So those 5, I mean, that sounds like something that would be very, very difficult to overcome, even though we know that in the last few years, there have been a number of pieces of legislation that they've been billed as property tax elimination bills that have probably made it closer to being passed than at any time over the past 4 decades or so.
Yeah, I think most recently, I think 4 years or so ago, a bill almost passed out of the Senate. It got deadlocked 24-24, and then the lieutenant governor at the time cast a vote against it as well.
Mm-hmm. So given all that, why do people want to get rid of property taxes?
The biggest argument is that you never truly own your home. That's, you know, senior citizens are, you know, they're on fixed incomes, and they just can't. There are other things you can cut back on, like if for sales tax, you could buy less things. For the income tax, that sort of, you know, is fluctuated to what you earn. But the property tax, you can't really control. And it just, for a lot of people, it seems like it just keeps going higher and higher.
We'll talk more about that for a moment, but let's listen to Bob Smith again.
There's a lot of things you can control and a lot of things you can, expenses that you can trim back on. But this property tax, there's absolutely nothing you can do about that other than move. And I always felt that it was pretty much unfair.
Well, I have to say that I've lived my whole life in Pennsylvania. I think that there are many, many people who would agree with Bob Smith that the property taxes are unfair. And as I said, probably the least favorite tax, most unpopular tax of all amongst Pennsylvanians. So you listed some of the reasons why it's difficult to eliminate them, but if we get into the politics of, you know, take the politics aside, why can't they be eliminated as far as, okay, sales tax being increased or more items being taxed or subject to the sales tax, the personal income tax being increased? I mean, it would seem to, it's universal that these are the property tax is unpopular. Why can't there be a majority of Pennsylvanians get together and say, okay, here's what we can do?
So it's the money. It's the about 4 years ago, it provided more than $13 billion of property taxes went to support the local school districts. That's a lot of money. And, you know, in Pennsylvania, it's a higher share of the burden is on the local property taxpayers than in other states. You know, so the sales tax would have to increase, the income tax would have to increase, and then you'd cover a lot more things by the sales tax. Clothing over a certain amount would be covered. Daycare would be covered, nursing care facilities would be covered. So there would be a lot of things that would get hit by it, you know, but that would have to, you'd have to tax in order to pay for it.
If you're just tuning in for the second half of Smart Talk today, we're talking with PA Post reporter Ed Mahan about the report that he's done, just updating where Pennsylvania stands with property taxes. I know you have a lot of opinions about property taxes. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so I have an email here from Laura who says, I wish I could listen fully today, but I have a meeting. So we just want to know that there are busy people out there, too. I hope that Smart Talk does a comprehensive review of the structure of Pennsylvania's state tax code. It is one of the 10 most regressive, meaning it negatively impacts middle and lower income people the worst, while letting higher income people skirt their full responsibility to contribute. Without fixing the state income tax, there is little hope for fixing the local property taxes. Fixing the income tax would provide more fairness and adequacy to the state tax code. Now, just as a, you know, for context, and Pennsylvanians are aware of this, Pennsylvania has a flat rate for an income tax. There are those who say, you know, that should not be, that it would be more fair to have a graduated tax like the federal income tax, where the more money you make, the more you pay in taxes. But the point that Laura makes about fixing the income tax, does this all go together?
I mean, it does. I mean, Tom Wolf, when he ran for governor the first time, he ran on the idea that he would change the income tax and make it a graduated income tax in Pennsylvania, a progressive income tax is what he called it. And then, you know, a lot of people said that wasn't constitutional and that a constitutional amendment had no chance of passing. He got into office and then he changed plans and he focused on a property tax change. I talked to him about that, you know, several years ago, and he said that he was trying to get at the a fairer tax system by like targeting where the property tax relief would go to. But that income tax issue and that property, his property tax proposal didn't go anywhere. But that income tax issue is a big one, and it looms large in this whole debate.
You mentioned a backlash. What kind of backlash?
So back in 1988, Governor Robert Casey, at the time, he pushed the legislators to pass a big property tax change. The basic crux of it was you'd have higher income taxes at the local level in exchange for property tax reduction. But as part of that, it had to come to it had to come to, voters had to weigh in on it through a constitutional amendment, and then voters rejected it in large numbers. And that was, you know, that was a different plan. And I think that you talked to some supporters of full elimination. They said one of the fears was you would have this change and then property taxes would be reduced, but then they would just go back up again in time. So that's why one of the reasons they think you just have to kill the school property taxes outright.
You know, I'm going to go back in time a little bit too, Ed. I think back to 2004 when Pennsylvania legalized slot machines, gambling, here in Pennsylvania. Since then, gambling has expanded a great deal. Mm-hmm. But the argument for legalizing slots by Governor Ed Rendell at the time and supporters was that the money that the state would generate from gambling, that would help to keep property taxes down. Now, the way it was handled, in that people didn't receive a check, but school districts did, and people didn't see it. Mm-hmm. So here we are 15 years later, and you have many, many Pennsylvanians saying, what happened to the slot machine revenue that was supposed to keep our property taxes down? What did happen to it?
Well, there's also the other expenses that have gone up. I mean, pensions have increased dramatically for school districts and for the state in that time. So you have pensions eating up a lot of the education money as well.
Well, in fact, along those same lines, Scott, who lives in Rutherford Heights but works at the Hollywood Casino, is on the line. Scott, I kind of touched on what you were going to ask, but go right ahead.
Yeah, I guess, like I said, you know, roughly 10 years ago, before the casinos came on board, I mean, that was a major article in the Harrisburg paper that all property taxes were to be eliminated if the casinos were able to get passed through, which certainly, you know, we all know they have. You know, we've got the multitude of casinos already. We've got 10 more coming down the road. And here we are still all paying the property taxes. Mm.
Hey, thank you very much for your call. Just to be accurate, I don't think that the Governor Rendell ever promised that property taxes would be eliminated, but that property taxes would go down by a percentage. Yeah. And again, people haven't seen it.
Yeah, and this is one of the reasons why the proponents say you have to kill it, because, you know, even if you reduce it, even if you do all these things to cut it down, you know, eventually school districts are going to have cost, they're going to have things they want to do, and they're going to raise the money, raise their property tax rates, and then you're going to be stuck paying more in the end.
Let's go back to another email that we have, and this goes along the lines of what the federal government does as well. D asks, why not increase the amount of exemptions to help seniors and low-income people?
You know, that is one of the things that lawmakers have been talking about, and I think there are some, you know, some targeted things to help seniors and low-income people. Now, I think there's been talks about freezing property taxes for seniors, homeowners who have had lived in their house for a certain amount of time. So that's one of the proposals. I think I'm not sure where those stand at this point.
Well, and there are people who would point out that there is property tax and rent rebate here in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. That there are senior citizens who. Well, I'm going to stop using the term senior citizens because I was told by those over the age of 65, they don't like that term. Okay. Mature Pennsylvanians who say that they you know, even though they do get that money back, there still are many of them who feel like they're going to lose their homes just because of the amount of money they pay in property taxes. Bob Smith, what were we going to say?
I guess one of the things, too, is, you know, the schools and other groups worry that, you know, eliminating the property taxes, you're just going to leave a big hole. The money isn't, the sales tax, the income tax, and the other things aren't going to be enough to make up the difference. And so you're going to need to have more cuts for schools.
You said that when you were talking about the property taxes increasing, there have been a number of moves made over the years, one called Act One. I'm not going to get too much into it, but what it was supposed to do was to give school districts, and because for the most part we're talking about school districts when we're talking about property taxes.
Yeah, school districts, that's where most of the property tax money goes.
Right.
Yeah.
Counties do rely on property taxes, but not to the degree that school districts do across this state. But there have been some moves made over the years that would supposedly give school districts some options to move to an income tax rather than a property tax. That if they reached a certain level of having to raise their property taxes, that voters would have to decide. Overall, those things don't seem to have really caught on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I remember I covered some of that, the initial stuff back in, I think, 2006, the early times. And I think there was just, at least in the area where I was covering it in suburban Philadelphia, there was some skepticism about whether they would actually get relief if they changed to these other taxes. And so I think there is that skepticism out there. But any sort of change, some people worry that they're not going to be better off by it.
See, that's
why change is hard.
and it also is counterintuitive, because when we know that the property tax is so unpopular, but yet few Pennsylvanians, I think, now granted, it's been a long time since 1989 mm-hmm. when Governor Casey had that ballot referendum. But, I mean, I think a lot of people at the time, I'm old enough to remember that, a lot of people at the time said, oh, this is going to pass overwhelmingly. But then once people took a closer look at it and say, hey, wait, you know, this could be a tax increase in disguise because you've got to replace that income and we'll go to other taxes. So it is counterintuitive that people hate property taxes, but they're afraid of what comes next.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things that is so looming so large is, like, Pennsylvania, we rank very low for the percent of money that the state provides towards K-12 schools. We rank, like, there's only four states that have a lower share. In Pennsylvania, the state provides about 38% of the money for K-12 schools. The federal government provides a little more. And then the rest of the burden falls on local property tax owners, or, you know, local district taxpayers. And so any kind of change is a massive one. There's only four states that provide a lower share, like Illinois, Nebraska, New Hampshire, and South Dakota provide a lower share than the state does in Pennsylvania. So it's a huge, huge change.
You also mentioned some of the factors that are leading school districts to spend more money. We know that over the years, there have been many people who have said, well, if the school districts would just control their cost, would just control their budgets, make cuts, those kind of things, that it would keep them from having to raise taxes. But the reality is, and I'm not making excuses for school districts, but you touched on one that is a huge driver of this, and that is pensions mm-hmm. for retired teachers, retired educators in these school districts. But there are others as well.
Yeah, and there are others, and I think there's some more, you know, progressive groups that argue that the real problem is the lack of significant state education funding increases. That, you know, there have been increases in recent years, but they would argue that they're more modest increases, and that these rising property taxes are a sign that these education funding increases aren't enough to keep providing an adequate amount of funding for schools. And then the other thing is, too, like, people in their school districts, I mean, they want good schools, you know, and so there's a conflict there as well.
A lot of conflicts in this, isn't there? It just goes to show why this is not such an easy issue to solve.
And the issue doesn't break down, you know, along party lines. Typically, there's a lot of geography that's a factor. And then when you look at the opponents, it doesn't break down along, you know, ideological lines. You have business groups, you have teacher unions. Groups that often might be at odds with each other are all against this as well, or all, you know, not all, maybe not all of them, but there's a lot of
often against
often,
it.
Yeah.
Well, and that's a point I wanted to make, is that there isn't universal, even though it is a despised tax, there isn't universal support for eliminating the property tax, or at least finding ways to reduce it, because there are some of those that benefit. Well, let's face it, one of the benefits of a property tax is it's a tax that is reliable.
Mm-hmm.
That you never know because it's a property tax is based on, the buildings that you have, the houses you have in a district, a tax base. That's kind of unpredictable. And there are some places, urban districts in particular, where tax bases are limited.
Yeah.
So for some, that's the reason that the property tax is, that's why they support it, is because it's reliable.
Yeah, and the income tax and sales tax, if you have an economic downturn, that can fall dramatically. Whereas a school district property taxes, it's not going to fall as dramatically. It might eventually fall, but it won't be as quickly.
So have there been any recent signs of hope for people like Bob Smith?
I think two years ago, a constitutional amendment did pass, and this opens up the possibility of eliminating property taxes just for homeowners, not for everybody. And so that is one possibility that David Argall, he's one of the main backers of this. You know, he still supports eliminating for everybody, including, big businesses, but because he says it's an unfair tax, but he says, the homeowner's only option is a real one, and one he's, could be considered. I mean, the thing about that, though, is it's still very, very expensive. I think that's like $8 billion as opposed to like $13 or $14 billion, so it's still a lot of money.
We have a York suburban school director who All has right. written to us and says, please remind Ed that the IFO, that's the Independent Fiscal Office, has published two comprehensive reports that show how the income and sales taxes proposed in Senate and House Bill 76 do completely cover the $14 billion in school taxes. There is no hole. What he is referring to is that one of the concerns is that, and there have been people over the years who have done their own research mm-hmm. and said that if property taxes were eliminated, replaced with sales and income taxes, that it wouldn't completely make up that $14 billion from the state. Joel is saying,
Joel,
yes,
serious? I know Joel. Hey, Joel. I think that, the IFO has done their studies. There have been different studies about it. I mean, I think Senator Jay Corman, the majority leader's concern. He voted against sort of some maneuvering to pass the bill a couple years ago, and his concern was whether the math added up. But I mean, proponents of it say it does. Joel is saying the IFO says it does. But I mean, it's still the income and sales tax increases are part of a concern for people, that they don't want to pay that more. And there are certain people who are going to, depending on their situation, are going to lose out. At least for a period of time, some people might.
Well, renters.
Renters.
People talk about the income tax being hurting the poor disproportionately because more of their income would go toward taxes.
And some people would now, too. I mean, but I guess it's the idea that, the people are often more afraid of what they're going to lose as opposed to trusting that they will eventually gain out.
Josh asks, just curious if there's a portion of property throughout the Commonwealth that ownership is unknown and therefore the tax is not being collected.
I'm not aware. I mean, I'm not aware of that issue.
But one thing that it reminds me of, Josh's question, is that the city of Harrisburg, for example, but all places have this, tax-exempt properties.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember correctly, the last figure I heard was around 45% of the city of Harrisburg's properties are tax-exempt because it's the state capital and you have government buildings mm-hmm. here. But it is an issue everywhere where there are a lot of tax-exempt properties.
Yeah, I covered that. I was down in New York for several years, and that was an issue the mayor would raise there. And that's one of the issues, that you have these, urban areas that might have nonprofits or other, government facilities. And that's one more reason why they're struggling, some of those urban areas. They have that, and, that's part of the argument over why we have an unfair tax system in Pennsylvania that really leads to these wide disparities in school district funding.
We only have about a minute left. Ed, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. We have a couple emails here
Great.
Who are talking about, we have too many school districts in Pennsylvania. That's one of the reasons that the taxes are so high.
We did a big story about that.
Yes.
I think I was on here
yes.
talking about that. And we talked about some of the reasons why we have so many school districts, so many superintendents. I think it's a challenge of consolidating them. There's fears about, who whether you're going to have to increase teacher salaries, and there's socioeconomic, racial differences among districts, and merging them is complicated.
There's a lot of fear in this state. So real quick, because we only have about 20 seconds, Ed, what Bob Smith did, we encourage people
exactly.
to papost.org. How can they do that if they have a question or an issue they'd like to see examined?
Go to papost.org. There's a listening post tab you can find, and then you can submit a question, and we might follow up, ask you some more questions, talk to you more.
Ed Mahan, PA Post, and you can read Ed's reports and stories at papost.org. Ed, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.